that what I want to talk about tonight is kind of two visions of the family. All right? Two visions of the family that I think are symbolized in this election, but are not let me put it this way, that the candidates who are running in this election signify these two visions of the family, but the visions of the family are much bigger than these two presidential candidates. And so I want to talk about that and talk about why that's such a big deal right now. So I've been studying presidential politics and rhetoric and news coverage and public opinion for about 15 years. And it is an interesting dynamic that we've had back-to-back presidents that have inspired a great deal of fervor and animosity. So back-to-back presidents. And what's interesting is that here in Seattle, this kind of hotbed of one of the more liberal major cities in the country, that you know the opposition to George Bush was very high in the 2000s. Anything after kind of like 2002, 2003, 2004, and so on. And so that animosity was extremely high. But just as a point of comparison, the animosity towards Barack Obama is so high that he was compelled at a certain point to produce a birth certificate. Okay? And that's takes it up to another level, that he didn't even think he was American. He had to prove that. We've never had a president said to prove that. And so I've been intrigued by this back-to-back kind of pendulum swing of this disagreement over a set of policies essentially with Bush, but then something that is somewhat policy related but seems to be something different with Barack Obama. And after thinking about it for quite some time, I've begun to locate it in these idea of the family. So here's how I want to kind of present this, is that there's an idea in British cultural studies for people who study kind of culture called structures of feeling. It's put forward by a guy named, by the name of Raymond Williams, who was writing back in the 1960s and 1970 and trying to produce a neo-Marxist critique of Western culture. And it's kind of one of those people that I would never have ever come across except I went to graduate school. And so in graduate school, you read these things and these folks, and you, at first, you don't understand them at all. And I remember my first year of my PhD, my head hurt trying to figure out what some of these scholars were saying. But by my fourth year, I was kind of getting it, right? And Raymond Williams became important for me in some of my thinking. And this idea of structures of feeling has been informative of my research and informative to me as a citizen. And his argument about what are structures of feeling, it's a concept, this idea of structures of feeling, is that there are things in society that are occurring sometimes that are quite profound and are structural, and are like a tectonic movement, but they aren't things that people necessarily can put their finger on or articulate very well. There's things going on, changes occurring that people can feel culturally and also can feel almost physiologically. So it's idea that you can feel certain things that you can't necessarily fully articulate. You can't put them into a graph very easily. You can't have a conversation about them over coffee very easily because they're deeper. They're culturally deeper than knowing what the weather is or what the number of people who are insured with health care are, which are very important matters, but don't quite kind of get at what he's talking about. He's talking about ideological change. And this kind of process this kind of dynamic of structures of feeling, Williams argues, is often only recognizable when there's these grand changes, only recognizable in retrospect, when those changes have become codified and put into policies in ways that you wished you would have kind of articulated and known at the time, and you felt, but you weren't really clear about, and then they become in retrospect eminently clear. Like, yes, of course, that was happening. That was going on. Yes, that's obvious. And these structures of feeling are often profoundly disruptive to people, and they in the midst of these changes, they are people search for saviors and the opposite of saviors, people you want to send to jail or worse. So you're looking for something to solve this anxiety, this disruption that you're feeling in these structures of feeling. And I have become convinced that we are in the midst of two major structures of feeling in the United States right now. We're in the midst of two profound shifts culturally that are being most profoundly felt in a negative way by ideological conservatives, by people that are truly troubled by these changes and are being noticed by progressives, but are not being seen, aren't being lived out in the same kind of terror as exists for conservatives. And Williams finishes his argument by saying that the early monitors of structures of feeling, those kind of canaries in the coal mine that tell you that something's going on, are people who are opposed to the changes. It's not the people that necessarily agree with the changes, it's people that are opposed to the changes. And so if you want to look at when there's profound change going on, who's feeling it the most and who is acting out the most are people who are opposed to these changes. And they may not fully grasp what's going on, but they're feeling something profound. Okay? So I want to talk about two that I think are signified in this election and have been signified for the last 4 years by Barack Obama and are present in this campaign in significant ways. The first is the racial change of the composition of the United States. The changing face of who is America. Who is America? Who are Americans? If you look at census data and you look at generational shifts, what we're seeing is that for almost until Generation X, which is my generation, which are folks who were born in the late 1960s up through the 1970s, up until then, most people were raised in the United States in a society that was 80% or more white. Okay? But beginning with Generation X, the numbers have dropped in terms of white composition significantly. And so we've begun to change dramatically. So much so that Generation Y, the letter, not the word, Generation Y, who are my students now, are being raised in a population in which the white, in America, in which the white population is about 58% of the society. Okay? So it's dropped from about over 80 in the last two generations. And this produces grand anxiety and change for people. It produces grand anxiety and it produces grand change. And that back to the anxiety, it produces anxiety certainly among those who are not thrilled with these shifts. But it also produces anxiety among those who may want these shifts but are trying to deal with the transformation, trying to cross-culturally process it, to live in the midst of it, to navigate it in all of the different heritages that come with these different groups. So you don't need to be, as many progressives would say, that only racists are deeply troubled or anxious about this kind of racial change. No, actually, you can be quite progressive and be still feeling the grasp of this change because it's such a significant deal. So much so that, you know, just 6 months ago we had these blaring headlines in news organizations about the fact that more than 50% of infants now born in the United States are non-Caucasian, are ethnic minorities. And that's part of this shift. But this is something that is seen as a symbol of this grand change. Okay? So this is going on. When you look at the University of Washington students, which is a predominantly a white institution across the street, but even there we are increasingly diverse. In the Department of Communication, my department, we are almost 50% undergraduate students who are students of color. And so this is a remarkable thing at the University of Washington. So this change is big. It's quite profound. Now, that's a big cultural shift that's going on, and it's changing the composition of the United States. It's impacting our discussions about immigration. It's certainly impacting our discussions about health care. It's impacting our discussions about a number of things. To bring it into the context of this presidential election, or this presidency and this presidential election, we have a president that is not only a president, he embodies this change. So we have a president that embodies this profound transformation. And he embodies it in two ways. First of all, he's black. I don't know if you've noticed that, but he is black. And so the reality is that we have our first, at least in terms of visible recognition, African-American president in the White House. And he embodies this grand shift. So for anybody who's feeling any anxiety at all in a negative way about these shifts, they don't have to be racist to nonetheless transfer that anxiety to this president because he symbolizes this. So it's a grand transference that occurs. He becomes the symbol that's the problem in their mind. But he embodies it in a second way, because he also would not be president now and will not be reelected on Tuesday if he is reelected, if it wasn't for this transformation. Because among white voters in the United States, his support is significantly lower than among non-Caucasian voters in America. In 2008, this president lost the white vote in the United States by about 60 to 40%. The only population among white voters that he won was the under 30 population. And he won them 66 to 34, crushed McCain in that, but lost all other older than 30 populations among whites significantly. And he's going to lose the white population on Tuesday by roughly about 60-40 again. And if it gets worse than that, if he loses it by 65-35, then he'll do the worst that any Democratic president has done in 40 years among the white vote. So he's only president because people of color elected him in very high numbers. And because that population was growing and had gotten big enough in American society to become a political force. So his reelection on Tuesday hinges upon those voters coming out again and with the changing composition of this society. So that if he loses the white vote worse on Tuesday than he lost the white vote in 2008, he can still be elected because the population that is now non-white has increased by a couple more percent since 2008. So his election and possible re-election hinges dramatically upon this shift that's occurring in our population. So we've got this guy who's the president, and forget all the policies, forget anything else about him. He embodies this tectonic shift that's going on in our society. And because of that, for many Americans, he is both the savior, because for people who might want this and embrace this multiculturalism, they look at him and say he's what my colleague Relina Joseph calls the exceptional multiracial. Okay, he's the one who is our future. He's the grand Messiah. And then for those who are opposed to this shift or are just feeling anxious about it in a deep way, they look at him and they say, I don't know what it is, but you're a problem and I don't like you. I'm going to oppose you with everything I got. I'm going to make sure that we never give you a vote when we're in Congress. We're not going to agree with you on anything. We're going to oppose anything you do, anything. So we've had unprecedented obstruction to this president. So this first shift is something that we live in the midst of. And the thing is, you got to get out of Seattle to feel a little bit of this. Seattle is such a white place tremendously and doesn't have the multiculturalism in the same way. But I've had the privilege with students over the last 9 months traveling around the country, covering the Republican primary and covering presidential politics and going to states from everything from a South Carolina to a Nevada, Colorado, Pennsylvania, Virginia, and so on and so on, to about 15 states, and seeing this play out across the country, this symbolism that this president has and tied to this racial shift. The second profound structure of feeling that is ongoing is got to do with definitions of marriage. Who gets to marry and who counts in the marital concept? Okay. If you look at attitudes about same-sex marriage or marriage equality or gay marriage, pick the terminology that you want to use. The reality is that the shifts on this issue are moving very rapidly in the United States, more rapidly than people can kind of keep track of. And, you know, on Tuesday, this is one of two states where you have a chance to, for the first time, affirm a legislature decision in the state that same-sex marriage is legal and should be fully constitutional. So in Maryland and here, we have that chance to affirm that without judicial fiat. This is moving very quickly. We also have a chance on Tuesday, not in this state, but in Maine, to repeal a law that banned same-sex marriage that was passed in 2008. So 4 years later, that same law is back on the books, but now the attempt is to repeal that, which had banned it in 2008. So things are moving very quickly. In 2012, earlier this year in North Carolina, they passed a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage, in fact, banning civil unions as well. And the primary proponent of this bill, a Republican in the state legislature there, the Speaker of the House, a few days before the state voted on it, it was an initiative that went to all the citizens of the state after being passed by the legislature because it was a constitutional amendment. The primary proponent of this stood up in the well of the House of Representatives in the North Carolina State House and said, we're going to pass this on Tuesday, and indeed they passed it 60-40 as a statewide vote. He said, we're going to pass this on Tuesday, and then in 20 years, you will repeal this. That's absolutely true. The recognition that this is occurring among those who are still trying to ban it tells us that they are well aware of this structure of feeling that's going on, this shift that's occurring. So I have this great graph, this great figure from a couple sociologists that tracks support for same-sex marriage by age cohort across all 50 states in the United States. It's from a couple years ago, and it's my favorite graph of all time because it lists all 50 states on it, and it lists by 0 to 100% and using all publicly available polls back in 2009 for support for same-sex marriage. And it breaks out by age cohort, 65 and older, 50 to 64, 30 to 49, and then under 30. And it tracks them across all these states looking at support for same-sex marriage. And what you see is a perfect generational shift in which the least support for same-sex marriage is among the 65 and older cohort across all 50 states. And then it's the 45 to 64 year olds, and then it's the 30 to 44 year olds, and then it's the under 30 year olds with from 0 to 100 with greater support going this way. Now nobody's up at 100. They were up around 50 or 60 among the older group, but you go from the older to the next youngest to the next youngest to the youngest, and it's almost perfectly statistically a shift. Okay. Across all of these 50 states, you can look at it. All the southern states in Utah are in the bottom of the graph in terms of support for it. And all the coastal states are up at the top in terms of support. So greater support at the top, less support at the bottom. But here's the kicker to the point, is that when you draw a line from the greatest state, the state with the greatest support among over 65-year-olds, which is Massachusetts in this graph, greatest support. They're about 30% among 65 and older folks for support for same-sex marriage. That's the highest of any 65 and older cohort for any of the 50 states. When you draw a line straight down the graph, this big line straight down the graph, and you take it to the bottom, you see that actually the greatest support for 65 and older, among 65 and older cohorts for same-sex marriage is less than the least support in any state for the under 30s. 65 and older folks on same-sex marriage in Massachusetts look like 30-year-olds and under in Alabama on same-sex marriage. It's almost exactly a line straight down. So you have this incredible generational replacement, what political scientists call generational replacement. And this dynamic of who gets to marry, who gets to vote on marriage, who gets the legal, who gets the cultural benefits of marriage, is also embodied by this president, who may be kicking and screaming, but came to address and support same-sex marriage in May. Apparently taking the position that being black wasn't tough enough for him politically, that he decided that he would come out in support of same-sex marriage, the first president to ever do anything like this, and in the midst of a re-election campaign. So there are all kinds of reasons this guy has let down progressives, but there are all kinds of things that he's had to overcome too. And the reality is that he embodies now that same-sex marriage shift in a way that he would not have embodied before. So he's African-American with this structure of feeling shift on race going on, and he supports, at least personally, same-sex marriage, although he's not defending DOMA either and has presided over the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So he embodies it in all kinds of ways, this shift on marriage and the definition of marriage. This structure of feeling on marriage, like the structure of feeling on race, is again most apparently being manifested, the anxiety over this, being most apparently manifested among people who oppose it. That they're deeply anxious and concerned about this issue and are mobilized around this in a way that is below the radar of most anybody in the city of Seattle who might be in this room. And are deeply engaged around this, so much so that they're given a pass. White evangelicals who are the base Republican Party are giving a pass for the presidency to a man that they're convinced is a member of a cult. Okay? Because they're willing to see this president as so disruptive to that notion of family and who gets to marry that if they allow him to be elected, that not only is he going to be socialist, or so they say, is also going to be, is going to enact certain definitions of marriage that are unacceptable. So we've got a presidency and a presidential campaign in which you have these two shifts that are occurring in our society that are fundamental to the American identity. Who we are racially and who we are in terms of marriage are not small matters. These are not like what kind of clothes are you wearing today. These are fundamental to who this country is and always has been. Race is a tapestry element that has been woven throughout American history, and definitions of family, have we been fighting over those from the beginning. So the reality is that these have come to the fore in the early 21st century with this president in this moment. This is what these is really at stake in this election. And you may already all be voting for Barack Obama. That's not my issue here. My issue is for us to recognize the tensions that are in play here. Because whatever happens on Tuesday, whatever side ends up winning this election, and I can tell you right now, Obama's going to win. But whatever side wins this election, there's going to be significant cultural repair work that has to be done. And that's where the people in this room come in. What are going to be the steps that we're going to take once all of the emotion of this week is over? What are you going to do? All of that cross-cultural work that people in good progressive circles in Seattle are well aware needs to be done on race, it needs to be done with white people. What are you going to do on the kind of cultural connective work that needs to be done around definitions of marriage when R-74 passes by 15 points in this state? Okay, what are you going to do? Or if it fails by 15? The first one seems more fun, right? But imagine if you're on the other side of it and it loses. That isn't just, it is every bit as exhilarating on one side as it is terrifying on the other. If Rich Lang could write a book about Christian fascism, then he felt that very strongly about Bush. You have to recognize that every bit as strongly are the feelings around these issues too. And we are people as adults who have a chance to engage on these matters, to engage in a conversation tonight, but also to engage in some significant cultural way with people who may disagree with us. And I think that that's the challenge I have for you is, do you want to do that work? I know who you want to win on Tuesday. And I know what issues you want to win. But I think there's more than that. There is. And these structures of feeling aren't going away after Tuesday. In fact, they're probably getting bigger. All right? So what are we going to do about that? Is it going to be your neighbor? Is it going to be someone at your synagogue? Is it going to be someone in your profession? Is it going to be someone in your family that you're going to have to talk honestly with and be vulnerable about? Because any reconciliation work that I've ever seen that actually works or been a participant in involves serious humility and honesty and often pain. So what are we going to do? Well, I would just say first we have to win on Tuesday. Then we have to... We have to be, if we do or you don't win on Tuesday, you gotta be willing to recognize and to look at yourself and say, you know what? It's important that we come together. And even if others don't want to come together, I can't let their behavior control my behavior. All right? Otherwise you give them the power. Right? So for all the flaws of this president, and he's as flawed as anybody, the one thing that there are many deep things that I deeply admire about him, but one thing in particular is that, in my view, he has never given up on trying to work with people who disagree with him. Many people who are progressives want him to give up, want him to have quit, to have walked away, to have used majorities for different purposes in the Congress, to have just stopped. But to me, he has embodied that everyday reconciliation work. He's African American. He has been, from the moment he became a candidate, told that he's Muslim, not American, a socialist. And yet, every day he goes out there and does, I think he's a model of grace. So, what about me as a citizen then? What about you as a citizen? What are we going to be after Tuesday, win or lose? I think that's the question I came to give you tonight. What are you going to do? Who are you going to be? Who's America going to be? What are we going to do after Tuesday? Because wherever you stand, wherever you sit, there's going to be a lot of work to be done. Okay? Q&A? Okay? Yeah. Oh, why do I think he's going to win? A couple things. Actually, I've been doing a lecture series on this for 4 years. And so the reality is that the change in racial composition of the country gives him an advantage in the Electoral College. Many of the states where there's been the greatest ethnic change in the country are key battleground states. Okay, there's only a few that aren't, like a Texas or a California. A lot of them are, though. You've had significant change in Florida, you've had significant change in Nevada, Colorado, and even in Virginia. So those states really make a difference, and that's why they become battleground states, because Nevada wasn't until Obama won. Colorado wasn't. Virginia hadn't elected a Democrat since 64. But now it did in 2008. So I think that those issues matter for him. That composition electorate works for him. Second of all, I think that he's maintained the support, enough significant support in the Midwest to win the key states there. That his support among white working class voters has diminished the least in the Midwest because of his auto bailout position. And I think that issue decides this election, and I think it should decide this election. I'm from Michigan. I'm from Detroit. I think there's nothing more culturally centered to the American identity than the automotive industry, for good or for bad. And the reality is that he took a position on that issue that was absolutely politically anathema at the time that he did it. And he did it, and he did it because he thought it was the right thing to do, and it's turned out right. So I think that he wins on that issue in Michigan. He wins on that in Ohio. He wins on that in Iowa, because it just kind of all goes together. He wins on that in Wisconsin, too. So I think that he holds those states. And the third thing I would say is that the reason I'm so confident of it today is that every politician has a tell. You know what tells are? A tell is when they may not be aware of it, but they're doing something that tells somebody else that clearly they're nervous or worried or something. And the clearest tell from the Romney campaign is that they've started absolutely bald-faced lying in Ohio. Not just kind of like somewhat lying, but absolutely completely lying on the auto bailout. Completely lying, saying that he supported it and that Jeep is moving jobs to China. Here's why that's such a tell to me. If you're going to be president, if you think you're going to win, and you need to work with the CEOs of the automotive industry, then you don't lie about their product 2 weeks before you're about to win the presidency, because you need them when you win. So these guys are all, and they're all guys, I think all these guys at the CEOs, they are going to vote for Romney, but every one of their workers now has heard in Ohio, in Michigan, this candidate in his ads, on TV, on radio, on the stump, say that Jeep is moving its jobs to China. And the GMs, the CEOs of Chrysler and GM have all said, this is a lie. This is false. So this would be like the president of the University of Washington, the guy who's about to be president coming from Utah, and saying something like this. The provost is cutting faculty jobs at the University of Washington and lying about that before he took the job here. What kind of relationship would he have if he came in the door after saying that about the provost and the faculty? We'd all hate the guy, right? So he's lying about that. And that is a bridge too far to me. You don't do that if you're actually winning.
Do you think people are not believing his lies?
Yes, I think they're not believing his lies. I do. I absolutely think that this is the case. There are moments when you go too far. And this is too far, because there have been people, worker after worker, who has heard him and has contacted political officials and leaders of their job, of their work, saying, I've heard this. Is this true? And they've been reassured that it's not. And then now they look at this guy, Romney, who they might culturally have been in sync with, and now say, you scared the crap out of my family and me. We can't trust that. And the newspapers in Ohio have been very critical of Romney on this. Yeah. I got to go, because I got to get my 11-year-old at the Moore Theater where he's dancing. Okay? So thank you. Have your conversation. And remember, the challenge is on our shoulders. Okay? So see you later. Okay?